In the this last issue of House to House, Heart to Heart, there were a few funny things. And if you're like me, you haven't heard too many funny things lately. So these might, you know, a merry heart does good like a medicine, Solomon said in Proverbs. So these are kids' instructions for life. This is Patrick, age 10. Never trust a dog to watch your food. And that's some good advice right there. Matt, 12. When you want something expensive, ask your grandma. This next one is really good. Those of you who are teachers, this is great. Andrew, 9. Never smart off to a teacher whose eyes and ears are twitching. Boy, is that a good idea. Carol, age 9. Never ask for anything that costs more than $5 when your parents are doing taxes. Ooh, that's good. Whenever your dad is mad and asks, "Do I look stupid?" don't answer him. Never tell your mom her diet isn't working. This is Joe, age 12. Don't pick on your sister when she's holding a baseball bat. Never dare your little brother to paint the family car. I don't know. I think that's a pretty good idea. That's just some.
Depends on the paint.
All right. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We got about the first third of it last time, verses 1 through 11. This next section in Ecclesiastes, this is kind of a paragraph, verses 12 through 17. One of the main lessons is that we can't control the future. We can't control the future. What do we say one of the, like, the main theme of Ecclesiastes was? Life under the sun is what?
Futile.
It's empty. It's vain. Right? Life without God has no purpose. Right? Solomon in this tries a lot of keys. Right? Key to find happiness. And we looked at some of those in the first chapter. Some in the first part of the second chapter. And what did we have to do? Where did we have to go to find the key? To God. He's the one that made the lock, right? So we have to go to Him to find the key. But that's the last place most people go, and most people don't even go there. And we see that from Solomon here. Okay. So here in verses 12 through 17, let's read a little bit of this to get started. Chapter 2, let's read verses 12 and 13. Would someone do that? Chapter 2, verses 12 and 13.
And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which hath been already done? Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly, as far as light excelleth darkness.
Okay. Now, let's look at those for a few minutes and kind of glean what we can from it. We see the word then. He's starting to kind of look at something else. Okay. He started to consider wisdom, madness, folly. And now he asks this question. Okay. He asks this question. For what can the man do, this is the New King James, who succeeds the king? Only what he's already done. What do you think? And this is, one of my reference books said, this is an extremely difficult verse, first of all, to translate, I guess, out of Hebrew, which I don't know anything about. And very difficult to really place in the book. But reading that, what kind of idea do you get Solomon is wanting to portray here in this last part? For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he's already done. What do you think he's trying to get across there?
Somebody's already done what you've done.
Okay. All right. That's good. Well, that's the thing that people had a real who exactly, because the word king here that's translated king out of Hebrew doesn't necessarily have to be translated king. I mean, it can kind of be translated different ways. One thought that he was talking about Adam, which makes a lot of sense if you read that and you read the verse. And for what can the man do who succeeds Adam? Only what he has already done. Is a human likely to come along who will be better than Adam, whom God made directly? See, he's kind of talking about something that's futile again. You know, that vain, empty idea again. There seems to be... I'm sorry, go ahead.
History repeats itself,
okay. People aren't getting inherently better, are they? They're not any more honest than they were in the past. They're not any more moral. They're not more ethical than they were in the past. People aren't getting better. All right? They're not. Their moral attributes are not getting better. That may be part of what he's wanting us to understand, too. That it doesn't make any difference what's going to happen in the future. People aren't going to, under the sun, with their own wisdom, get better. They can't get better. All right? And he talks in a few verses down about something that I think is one of the most important things in our society and in the world. And he addresses this, you know, 3,000 years ago, which shows man hasn't changed. All right, in verse 13, he talks about one result was that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. In what way? In what way would wisdom excel folly? Maybe at least one.
Makes you think before you act.
Okay. Someone who is wise maybe is going to avoid certain pitfalls, maybe. Okay. What else might he be referring to here? Because this chapter has a lot to do with this section, with what lies ahead and the future. So in what way would the wise person then be better than the one who's folly or fool?
I was thinking that we need to learn from history. We need to learn from the mistakes
okay.
that people in the past have made.
Okay. That would keep us from repeating them, right? Okay, so the wise man is, if he really learns, is going to be better prepared for things that happen in the future. Because things are going to happen in the future that's out of his control. So the wise man is going to be at least some better, better prepared, more knowledgeable, something, about things that's going to happen. Because there's going to be troubles. There's always going to be troubles. I think that's something Solomon points out in this book, right? Under the sun, there's always going to be trouble. I mean, until the day this world ends, there's always going to be trouble. It's never going to go away. But we can be better prepared than others when trouble comes. But it's not by our own wisdom that we're better prepared. It's God's wisdom. That's the only way we can be better prepared. A lot of times in the Bible, what is light and darkness? What do they refer to quite often?
Good and evil.
Good and evil, right? Right and wrong, okay? God and Satan, those type of things, right? And that's he's kind of making that, I guess, comparison there in verse 13 as well as to what could be happening. All right. Let's see. Let's look now. Would someone read verse 14 now back in Ecclesiastes 2?
The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all.
Okay, now he had just said that wisdom exceeds folly. Wisdom, the wise man exceeds the foolish man. Now he says, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. What is he trying to get across there? What point does he want us to understand, or lesson does he want us to understand? Before he gets to the last part.
Verse
when he says the wise man's eyes are in his head?
The wise man looks where he's going. The fool just kind of stumbles around in the darkness.
Yeah, just stumbles around in the darkness. Okay? And that's often when the fool falls into those pits and falls into the traps, right? When he's stumbling around in the darkness. But then he says, the end of that verse, that's why sometimes this book is difficult to understand. He says, yet I perceived something, I saw something, and that is that the same event happens to them all. What do you think he means by the same event?
Everybody dies.
Everybody dies. The wise and the foolish. Everybody dies. Okay? It happens to everybody, right? Isn't that what the Hebrew writer said? It's appointed for man to die once. Which men? All men. Everybody. Okay? It happens to everybody. So that's just part of life. The difference is the wise man will be the one who prepares for death, for that event. The foolish man doesn't. He'll stumble through life in the darkness, and then death overtakes him, and he's not ready. Which is a profound lesson in and of itself, is to always be prepared for death. Not that you're always fearing it, but that you live in such a way that, well, okay, if today is it, then I've done what I can to be prepared for it. Where the foolish man never even thinks about it, right? And of course, in the Bible, the foolish man is often the one who doesn't believe in God, right? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So that person doesn't think there's anything after death anyway. So who would care? The wise man knows different. Knows that death is just the beginning of a whole new life. So see, their whole view of death is different. The wise man and the foolish man view death entirely different. I remember several years ago, when I was preaching at Aurora, there was he's a well-known lawyer still in Springfield, and you'd know his name, so I won't use it. But his mother passed away, and we were having her funeral there in Aurora. So he came in and talked to me, and we were talking about death and all those things. And it became very obvious that he didn't believe in an afterlife at all. And I was talking to him about, you know, where the choices that you make determine your life and the things that you do. And it was very obvious he didn't believe in any of that. He thought the whole thing was just, well, what you did in this life, if you lived a good life, well, you influence people after you've died. And that was it for him. That was the whole thing. That was his whole viewpoint of death. And I was thinking, well, how sad that is. I mean, that's just a sad view of life. That's a depressing view of life, to think that this is all there is. What if you were born with some awful disease and lived with it all your life, and that was all there was? I mean, think how horrible that is. That viewpoint is just a tragic view of life. But yet, there are an awful lot of people who believe it. Especially, Western Europe is now about the most atheistic place in the world. And a huge percentage of those people believe in no type of afterlife or God or anything. I mean, it's become very secularized. That's just a sad viewpoint of things, sad outlook. So the wise can see death coming. You know, they know that there's going to be death, so they can consider it and think about it. And come to know, how do I need to live to be prepared for it? let's see. Verse 15. Would someone read verse 15? This kind of follows right on the heel of it.
So I said in my heart, if it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity.
He's kind of talking to himself, right, about this very serious subject. And so he's saying, well, it happens to the fool, it happens to me. Again, the idea is that death is inevitable, that end is inevitable, that just because he maybe has more wisdom, that's not going to keep him from dying. Wisdom can't do that. Wisdom cannot keep you from dying. Wisdom can help you prepare for death, but it can't keep death from you, because death overtakes everyone eventually. And so there isn't any way around that, regardless if you're wise or not. You can't get away from that. And so, why was I then more wise? And I said in my heart, this also is vanity. This awareness to Solomon here is kind of a sobering thought to him. Of course, as it should be a sobering thought. All right, verse 16, please, someone.
For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool.
Okay. So that's, that same thought is there, but remember, everything is about the future. You can't control the future in the sense of you can't get rid of death. All right, it is coming. And it will overtake you. You don't know when it's going to overtake you. I mean, you know, we see from young to old, doesn't matter. It is always there. But he says there's no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. What do you think he's wanting us to know today? What is it you think he's wanting us to know?
What we do on earth doesn't really matter to man.
Okay. And it doesn't, you know, I kind of mentioned this, I think, a couple of weeks ago. Even, you know, we all, I remember people that I grew up with that I thought accomplished a lot and maybe were good businessmen or whatever, all right? But people nowadays don't know any of them. So that goes with the passing of time. It's not remembered. And even some of the names we do remember, we know very little about. So, again, that idea of, you know, there's nothing I can do about that. I cannot control that. You can't, I can't, nobody can control that. Death is still coming, and he's going to talk in a few minutes about what, in a few verses, what we really need to be focusing on in our life. But that's certainly part of it, that we cannot control the future. So his result in verse 17 is, in this section, therefore, there's my result, I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Why did he say he hated life? That's not the only time he's going to say those type of things in this book, but why did he hate life? What do you think he was, you know, saying that? Okay, life is a battle. That's right, because he's still looking at all those things under the sun, right? All of those things. And to me, and I've said this before, life without God, everything ends up being meaningless. Everything you do in life ends up being meaningless if you're apart from God. I mean, it takes... There's no way to have real happiness apart from God, real joy apart from God, regardless of what you accomplish. If it's just in this world, then it's, you know, there's no purpose to it. Like you said, it's grasping for the wind. And when it's done, you have absolutely nothing. And yet our society, though, is going after that, pursuing that at breakneck speed. And they, you know, they want anything to do with God, or you don't even, in some places, you're not even supposed to mention God. That's like a horrible thing, to mention God. And I'm glad I don't live in those places. Yes.
He's realizing, too, that all this physical gain and wealth is just momentarily enjoyed.
Yeah.
The thrill of it soon.
Yeah, it's very, very fleeting, isn't it? Very fleeting. And he gets really into that here in the next section, that about those possessions. And so he kind of just ends up this little section saying that if you're, you know, there's nothing good about life if it's lived entirely under the sun. There's nothing really good about it. Any part of it is not good if it's apart from God. It's not worth living. So even if you do prolong your life a little while, if you're living under the sun apart from God, that's not any better. Because you're still not going to find happiness regardless of how long you live if you're not living with God or for God. It's not there. It's going to be just as elusive 50 years from now as it is right now if you're living apart from God. Tremendous advice. I mean, isn't that just tremendous advice? Certainly our world needs to heed those words greatly. We're so just so intense about all these things, and you see, you know, all the deceit and fraud in the business world, and it's all about greed and money and wanting more. And Solomon says, it's not there. There's no happiness or joy there. It's not. So don't waste your time pursuing it because there's no happiness there.
The media nowadays is deceives us.
Oh, well, sure.
They show these wealthy people always with smiles on their faces.
Yeah.
And good times going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the average person thinks, well, that'd be great to be like that.
Right. Very good point. All right. Well, now he goes into the second part, beginning in verse 18. Through the rest of the chapter, well, really, it kind of goes to, where was it? Verse 23. And this is basically the vanity of labor. And of course, that doesn't mean that work is not good. Work is good. But work is not good that's under the sun. See, it's all about, you know, why are you working? What are you working for? Who are you working for? And so that's what Solomon kind of turns his attention to now in verse 18. Now he says, I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun because I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I've shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Now he's got this, this is kind of a quest for wealth and possessions. So that's why he's working. He's not working to help somebody or to provide for John Doe over here. He's just working to get this, these things.
Do you think he realizes now that you can't take it?
Yeah, that's true. That's why Jesus said, you know, don't lay up for yourself treasures on earth. Okay? They're soon going to be gone. Well, isn't that what he says in this verse? He says, everything that I get, all my wealth and possessions, lands, whatever, he says, will eventually be left to someone else. And it is. It's all left to someone else. Sometimes it's left to the government. Sometimes it's left to a society. Sometimes it's left to a charity. Sometimes it's left to family. But his point is, you know, if I'm doing all this to get wealth and possessions, it's not going to be with me. I have to give it to someone else. And who knows how foolish they may be with that. Okay? Who in here wants to leave all their money to the government? That'd be like the last place I want to leave all my money to. Because I don't think they would use it very wisely. Well, that's what Solomon is saying. He says, if I use all my time on earth and effort to get more and more wealth and possessions, it's not going to do me any good. Because someone else will end up with it. And how many times have you heard or read about, you know, somebody that worked up from nothing and became a multimillionaire, and then his kids or grandkids blew it all and they have nothing? And again, that's what he's talking about here. That happens. So there's Solomon wants us to understand that we cannot live and work just to get wealth and possessions, because that's living under the sun. And it's futile. It's vain. It's empty. Has no purpose. So that's why he said he hated it. Not that work is bad, but if you're laboring to get more and more wealth and possessions, Solomon says, you'll end up hating it. Because there's nothing there. That's not the key to happiness. That's not the way to find joy. He says it's not there. It doesn't make any difference how much you have. It's not there. You will end up being miserable. And of course, we know people who, you know, kind of fit into that. And when you think about, you know, this is Solomon. His son, Rehoboam, ended up basically losing, if you might say, a lot of the wealth of the kingdom that Solomon had gotten. You know, all kinds of tribute money and so forth was brought in. But by the time of Rehoboam, his son, he ended up giving away a lot of it. When he was specifically told not to, by the way. He wasn't being charitable. He was kind of, I guess, in a way, showing off, maybe, in a sense. But anyway, there was an example with the writer where that happened after Solomon was gone. So it has been around for a very, very long time. So, okay, verse 20. Therefore, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. So this, you know, he says this obsession with trying to get more and more wealth and possessions is just empty. It is just an empty pursuit. You get to the end and you've got nothing. And you look back and you've essentially wasted your life, because all you've used your life for is just to get more and more. And Solomon says that'll get you nothing in the end. You will end up losing. Yes. Oh, is that the one about the rich? Yeah. 16, verse 12?
No, it's chapter 12, verse 16.
Oh, I had it backwards. Chapter 12, verse 16.
Down to 21.
Oh, yeah. The prayer ground of a rich man yielded plentifully, and he thought within himself, what shall I do since I have no room to store my crops? What would have been the right thing to do at that point? For the rich man.
Share.
Share, right? Share. Okay? But that was not what he was concerned about. So he said, I'll do this. I'll pull down my barns and build greater, and there I'll store all my crops and my goods, and I'll say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. It's still all about himself. Everything's about himself there. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you've provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. And that's what Solomon, you know, this Solomon was doing these things. This was like his big experiment. Yes.
Also, instead of putting all that labor into filling his barns, or having so much they had to put out there,
mm-hmm. Yep.
He should have put it toward working for the Lord.
Okay. Yeah.
Realization.
Yeah. He had more stuff, and so he had to get bigger stuff to put his other stuff in, right? That's kind of a never-ending cycle. The more stuff you get, you have to get bigger stuff to put the stuff in. Yes?
He had an even more modern example, too. I can't remember his name. Famous story about him. He has a huge estate out in California, and he amassed a great fortune. He had a living, huge stinks up and it's like zoo, everything on this place. And he's always trying to try and get more and more. But on his deathbed, the last word he said was of something from his childhood, the last time he could remember being home.
None of those other things were what was on his mind.
He had misery the whole rest of his life. He had this huge barn. You know, the estate is astounding.
Yes.
How many of us have storage rooms rented at various places?
Oh, I need one. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to write that. That's exactly right, right? We can lower it to our scale and still be the same issue, the same problem. Right. That's very true. You don't have to have vast amounts of wealth for that to be a problem. Because what Solomon's writing is for everybody, isn't it? Doesn't make any difference how much you have. Solomon says that isn't going to get it. One of the main themes, or maybe the whole theme of the book, is that life without God or apart from God has no meaning. You know, when it comes to the very end of our life, whenever that happens to be, the only thing that's really going to matter is my relationship with God. Do I have a right relationship with God? Am I in good standing with God, or I'm not? And nothing else will really matter. All the positions I've held, or the jobs I've held, or the houses I've lived in, or the vacations I've gone on, or so forth, those things can actually take you away from God, from having a relationship with God. So the important thing is that when it all is said and done, you know, what's your standing with God? Have you been immersed? Have you had your sins washed away? Have you started that Christian race? Have you experienced the new birth? And then have you been faithful? Have you done what you could in the kingdom? You know, with what you have and your resources and your abilities, have you used them for the kingdom, or have you used them entirely selfishly? Those things will determine our relationship at the end of time. When our time is up, whenever that is, whether Christ comes again or whether we pass on, the same is true. You know, what is your relationship? And there's probably not a better question that we need to know the answer to. We need to know the answer to that today, don't we? We need to know if our relationship is right. The wonderful thing about Christianity is you don't have to go to some temple or some priest or anything like that. You can take care of those things essentially at any time. And that's what's wonderful about it. You can experience the new birth, that baptism for the forgiveness of your sins. You can do that at any time of the day, any day of the week. It doesn't have to be on a specific day. It doesn't have to be by a specific person. You don't go find a specific person that has to do it. There isn't anything holy about the person that performs the baptism. They don't have to be some sort of ordained anything. Anyone like that can do it. So it makes Christianity, in a sense, a very wonderful faith because of that. There isn't a lot of bells and whistles like there are in so many. It's a very, very simple, straightforward faith. And then he just asks us to continue to be faithful. Whenever we need to ask God for forgiveness, we need to ask God for forgiveness for whatever the sin might happen to be. Sometimes that needs to be done publicly. Sometimes it's not. But that's always available. And so those are the things we need to think about. You know, life without God has no purpose. Life without God has no meaning. So tonight, if you have a desire to answer that invitation, we encourage you as David leads us in this song.